From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Who can say where the road goes, where the day flows, only time?
It's a story of hope.
You know what's amazing? You can. You can have a really good life.
A story about love.
The big mystery is why females should eat a male before he's copulated. Obviously, for the male, this is a disaster.
And most of all, it's a story about ideas.
With Einstein's brain in the trunk, driving through a McDonald's drive-thru suddenly became this huge event. I just constantly had the urge to scream, "We got the brain, it's in the trunk."
Public Radio International and Wisconsin Public Radio proudly present To the Best of Our Knowledge, the movie, starring Jim Fleming.
But you've succeeded in scaring the hell out of me.
Steve Paulson.
This is a pretty racy subject, isn't it?
And Anne Strangehouse.
So was dressing up as a girl something you did just once or twice for kicks, or did it get to be a regular thing?
Don't miss the movie that critics are calling the intellectual thrill ride of the year. To the Best of Our Knowledge, the movie. Coming soon to a theater near you.
Are you tired of hearing films described as the feel-good movie of the season? And not that there's anything wrong with feeling good, but do you ever wish there was such a thing as a think-good movie? Well, there are. And we're going to look at some of them this hour as we explore film through the lens of philosophy, and philosophy through the lens of film. From Andy Warhol's 8-hour movie of the Empire State Building to the philosophy behind the Fists of Fury in Fight Club. Also, what screenwriter Charlie Kaufman can tell us about being Charlie Kaufman, and about being in general. But first, you know how sometimes a movie just gets under your skin? You watch it over and over. You can sing the theme music. You can quote the director. Writer Jeff Dyer is the author of Zona, a book about a film about a journey to a room. It chronicles his 30-year-long obsession with the Russian filmmaker Andrei Tarkovsky's 1979 film, Stalker.
The storyline of Stalker is so incredibly simple. There's this place in an unspecified country called the Zone, and it's forbidden. You're not allowed to go there. It's surrounded by some sort of military cordon. And there's a guy called a stalker, who's really a guide, and he is taking two clients, one called writer and professor, into this zone, at the heart of which it's claimed, although there's no proof for this, your deepest wish will be realized. It's important to emphasize that it's not, say, three or four of your top wishes, it's only your deepest wish. And that's it, really. That's the plot of Stalker, which lasts 2 hours and 40 minutes, reduced to about 25 seconds. Stalker was released in England in 1981. I went because it was very, very favourably reviewed, and it was incredibly slow, and I would be lying if I said it was one of those afternoons where I look back and, yes, it changed my life, because although I could see the film had all sorts of qualities, it certainly wasn't love at first sight. I didn't come out of it overwhelmed. But what happened is that it continued haunting me for an awful long time, approximately 30 years. After that first time I saw it, there were certain scenes in it that stayed with me. In a way, that's quite a general thing. If you go to any film, however bad, there's always a brief period when you emerge from the theatre when the world outside is kind of tinted by what you've been seeing inside. Now, with a really insignificant film, that actually probably lasts for about 2 or 3 seconds, and I think the better the film, the longer that experience whereby the world itself is reconfigured by what you've seen. And for me, with Stalker, all sorts of little things would come up, both interior scenes and certain moments in landscapes would just bring me back and remind me of something in the film, to the extent that I wanted to go back and see the film again, if you like, to verify if my memory of it, if the kind of evoked memory coincided with what was really there on the film. And one particular occasion, I was walking with my then girlfriend in Richmond Park in West London, and we saw a bird flapping low over the sloping landscape in a way that was so reminiscent of a famous moment in the film when a bird flaps over this weird interior landscape of sand dunes in the zone. And then in the film, one of these strange magical moments happens. The bird just disappears. And that was when I really did decide that I had to go to see it again. Do you know, there are so many scenes in Stalker that make tears come to my eyes now. So the film is 2 hours and 40 minutes. I could probably spend 2 hours and 40 minutes describing the sequences that make me cry. There are a number, though, that I need to emphasise, I think. The first one is when they arrive in the zone. After this long tracking sequence of the three men's faces as they're moving along the railroad track going into the zone. And then, magically, we're in this world of colour and in the zone. You know, there's no doubt about it. We're there. We're somewhere else. I mean, that is just a wonderful moment.
No, what? Wait, Doma.
Shortly after that, the Stalker goes off for a walk on his own and he collapses on his knees into the grass in a state of ecstasy, I would say. And it's so incredibly moving because he believes absolutely in this place, in its magical, in its redemptive powers. And it hasn't disappointed him. I mean, I find that as a moment of affirmation quite extraordinary. We're told that one of the consequences of going to the zone is that children of stalkers tend to be born with deformities. And we've seen that the stalker's child, this young girl called Monkey, we've seen that she's crippled, that she can't walk. And then when they get back from the zone, we're there in black and white. But then we shift to a very close, a very tight shot of Monkey in profile, in colour. And she's walking. And it's this beautiful thing. It's a miracle. She can walk. But it's a miracle that even Richard Dawkins would be happy to accept, because it turns out that actually, as the camera moves back, we can see that she's not walking. She's just on her dad's shoulders. He's giving her a ride like that. And as the camera pulls back, we can see Stalker walking with the kid on his shoulders, with his wife, unbelievably beautifully, with this doggy that he's brought back from the zone, which is proof in a way that they've been there. And they're walking through this absolutely desolate sort of post-industrial bloated Eastern European landscape, and it's so beautiful. I find I'm overwhelmed by that. And then perhaps I shouldn't say what it is, but the very last sequence when it's revealed to us that, yeah, even though the daughter is physically disabled, the sort of compensation for that is considerable. The journey to the zone is in many ways a very, very literal one. A lot of the film is taken with their getting through the zone to this place, the room, where their deepest wish will come true. The closer they get to this fabled room, the slower their progress becomes, and the more they get burdened down by these kind of philosophical discussions and quarrels and fights. And then it turns out incredibly that one of the people is going to try to destroy the room. So there's this kind of quite funny fight sequence as these three old guys kind of wrestling in a puddle. You know, they've come all this way at considerable risk to enter the room where their deepest wish can be realised. And then, for different reasons, they sort of balk and hesitate about that. And the reason for this is because, as Stalker emphasises, it's not just any wish. It's not just what you think you might want, which would be, you know, well, I don't know what you might want. It's only your deepest wish, which means that your true nature will be revealed to you.
Это самый важный момент вашей жизни.
If one thinks about that for a second, you know, when you're a kid, you always jump at the chance to sneak a peek at people's diaries or to hear what people have said about you. But actually, as you get older, you realise you're probably better off not knowing what people really think about you. And so, this thing, the room, which has seemed such a marvellous place, there's an aspect of horror about it too, as, you know, what you'll do is you'll look in the mirror and see yourself not as you believe yourself to be, as a rather nice, considerate, caring person, but potentially, and there are stories about such things happening in the film, potentially as a rather, you know, as a rather lesser, more malign, selfish person. Any philosophical points, I think, are also constructed. They're made by the movement of the camera. There's a lot of stuff about perception, and what we're seeing in the film, even our sense of how long they're there, how much ground has been covered, that's being controlled, manipulated, and indeed constructed by the movement of the camera. There are three characters in the zone, Stalker, Writer and Professor, but you're also aware of this other, this fourth presence, and it's the camera that's there very much as a character in its own right, and in some ways you get the impression maybe the camera is the kind of sentient spirit of the zone itself. As I've done events in different countries, I've been so surprised at the way that people would come up to me afterwards and say, let me tell you about the first time I saw Stalker. They would describe the circumstances, they would remember the cinema where they saw it. It was funny, I became so conscious of this when I was doing a gig in San Francisco, which I visited a lot, and I always remember when I first went to San Francisco, this was back in the 80s, you know, I'd get people talking about this transformative experience, the night they first ever went to a gay bar, this moment when they were able to become themselves. And people were recounting the first time they saw Stalker in similarly transformative terms. My book, Zona, it's about this film, but it's also about the way that certain big artistic experiences, they really form who you are. I mean, they really become part of you. They shape your whole sense of what it is to be alive. And it's also, I think, in a way I can see it that it's a nostalgic book, because that time when one was completely at the mercy of both art house cinemas and their scheduling and film festivals, you would be aware that certain films had this great reputation and you might have to wait a considerable length of time before you got a chance to see them. So it's very much about, as well, the magic and the power of cinema. There's a load of debate, all sorts of commentary about what the zone is in Tarkovsky's film, and it seems to me that, I mean, we could talk about that till the cows come home, but the zone is about, you know, the wonder of cinematic space and the things that can be revealed and that can be made to happen there.
Jeff Dyer is the author of Zona, a book about a film about a journey to a room. Is there a movie you love as much as Jeff Dyer loves Stalker? Tell us what it is. You can send us a message on our website, ttbook.org. Coming up, we'll look at Andy Warhol's film career and try to get inside the inventive mind of the screenwriter Charlie Kaufman as we continue our hour on film and philosophy. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. You're probably familiar with Andy Warhol's artwork, his Campbell soup cans, screen prints, his images of icons like Marilyn Monroe and Elvis Presley. But chances are you are not nearly as familiar with Warhol's film career. In fact, Andy Warhol was obsessed with making movies. They're not easy to find, but filmmaker J.J. Murphy tracked them down and watched them. Murphy's the author of The Black Hole of the Camera, the films of Andy Warhol. He tells Anne Strangechamps about viewing Empire, Warhol's 1964 film about the Empire State Building. It's a film that lasts 8 hours and 5 minutes.
I really thought, oh, okay, 8 hours. It means that it's like going to work, right? You're going to go sit there. You're going to sit there for 8 hours, and it's just going to play, and you have to coordinate your pit stops because the film is going to keep going. And the thing about the film is it really starts at sunset and then it goes into night. And it becomes this very, very, very peaceful film. And for me, it's almost like a journey into outer space. And Warhol talked about it was like Flash Gordon going into space. And it really is like a trip into outer space.
Because that lighted top part of the Empire State Building looks like a rocket at night?
Well, you know, it does initially, but then as it becomes dark, different things start to happen. But there's another thing that happened with that particular film. It was shot in black and white. I believe it was shot in negative film. And negative is a very difficult film to deal with. And he obviously brought it to a lab that didn't know how to handle the film very well. And consequently, there are a lot of blotches and marks on it and these very strange patterns that actually appear on the film stock. So between the depth of the image and the material of the film, there's this sort of tension, but it really starts to appear like stars in the galaxy. It's a little bit like the Vaya Selman Starry Night painting series. That's the experience of the film for me. Each section is different, and I describe it in some detail just because it was important to get at what happens. But it's not that nothing happens. There's actually quite a bit happens in the course of that film as different lights get turned off and things change, that you have these marks on the film. You seem to be on this journey. So I think it's very interesting that he didn't film it during the course of the day, which is, you know, I think most people would have thought he would do, but that he figured out to do it that way. Warhol was into high concepts, like the idea of 5 hours plus of a person sleeping, and everybody thinks then, oh, I don't have to see the film. And the same thing with 8 hours of the Empire State Building. I mean,
you think you just get the concept and that's it.
And there are high concepts in Warhol. And some blogs have talked about things like, well, of course, it's just a conceptual film. You would never have to see it. I think that's completely wrong. You do have to see it. When I saw Sleep, and I went with one of my grad students, and when we left the theater, we were both shocked. We could not believe how different the experience of the film was.
Now, he also did make films with actors, people who move around, do things on screen, but even then, he didn't really like plots or even scripts very much.
No, he worked with a screenwriter who wrote scenarios, and I'm talking about Ronald Tavell, who was a playwright and a writer. But Warhol more or less subverted the scripts that Tavell wrote, and that's part of the tension of the films that he made with Tavell, which are actually some of the most interesting ones that Warhol made. He didn't really like plot either. He said that when films have plot, then once you know the plot, you would never want to watch it again. I don't necessarily agree with that. There are many films that have plots that I see multiple times, but for him, that's the way he saw it.
Well, he also seems to have really wanted somehow to film reality.
He was very...
He didn't want acting.
Right. His idea of acting really comes from Jack Smith, and it's that the real personality of the actor comes through. So he would think that Meryl Streep would be a terrible actress or actor because it has to do with the level of artifice in Hollywood performance. I mean, there's a certain type of acting, but it has a high degree of artifice. That was the opposite of what Warhol really considered to be good acting. For Warhol, acting was when people were themselves, when they slipped from being in a role where they're unselfconscious and they're just being themselves and their real personality shines through.
Now, Warhol was also really interested in the concept of the star, the superstar. He had a superstar on film. He loved working with Edie Sedgwick.
Mm-hmm.
Now, who was she and what was so captivating about her for Warhol?
Well, I think that Warhol, when he found Edie Sedgwick, I think that he thought he had found Marilyn Monroe. She had a kind of presence about her. There is this mysterious thing that happens when certain people are filmed, right? Where all of a sudden there's this transformation that occurs, like on the camera, And that's why people do screen tests. Edie was like his beautiful twin on some level. She was from a very wealthy family. She was from Cambridge, came to New York. She became a highly successful fashion model. And he wanted to create vehicles for her to be a movie star. She was in Vinyl. In Vinyl, he added her at the last minute, and all she did was sit on a trunk on the side of the frame. And what's interesting about the film, that was a star vehicle for Gerard Malanga. But when you watch the film, you watch Edie. She somehow is so captivating that you watch her reaction to everything that's taking place because she hasn't a clue what's taking place. And what's taking place, there are all these scenes of torture and whatnot, and she doesn't know what's going on. And so it registers. She becomes kind of the moral conscience of the film. And there are times when there are dance numbers where there are times when she gets into it and then she realizes that that's sort of an inappropriate response. And so it really becomes fascinating to watch her.
He made one movie about her poor little rich girl.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And half of it's out of focus. The first half of it's out of focus. And the thing that I find interesting is you can watch it and it's still fascinating even though it's out of focus. I mean, how many people can watch an out of focus film?
But the most of the film, right, is just Edie kind of getting dressed, sitting on her bed, making up her face, putting
exactly.
on music, getting ready to
exactly.
go out, talking on the phone.
Yeah, exactly. And occasionally she comes in for a very brief moment. She'll come into focus and then it'll be put out of focus again. I mean, it was deliberately shot out of focus. And then in the second half of the film, it's like we're in her dressing room. And it's so shocking after the first part because we can't really see her. And then to be able to see her and she's undressed and she has just a bra and panties and she's sitting there and she's being interviewed. And it's a very subtly manipulative interview where she gets a phone call. She was fascinated with Bob Dylan. And so there were all these digs at Bob Dylan. So there are Bob Dylan songs.
Different from what I did
last week, but that's not
so bad. Somebody told me that I changed so much each time they saw me that they didn't recognize me. Do you believe that? I don't think it's true.
Chuck Wine, who's really supposed to be her friend but sort of betrays her in all the films in which he collaborated with Warhol. The basic setup is that he's her confidant, but then he does something to betray her in the course of the film. And what happens in that film is that she gets very stoned, and so she doesn't realize what is going on.
Did she feel later watching these films, did she feel betrayed and manipulated?
Yes, she did. Yes, and she had a falling out. She eventually came to think that people were making fun of her in the films.
And sounds I don't like think they
that, were. Yes and no. I don't think that Warhol was making fun of her. I think that he thought that she was just really interesting, and he was trying to find ways to make her interesting. I don't
a little uncomfortable, too.
Yeah.
So one of his most famous films is The Chelsea Girls.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a film in which he tried something technologically really on the edge, two screens
mm-hmm.
with two different films playing simultaneously.
Right. So that the film is never the same because the projectors aren't synchronized and so they're staggered. And so it's always, it depends on the projectionist being able to follow instructions. And the instructions are fairly complicated. So anytime that you see it, it's going to be slightly different depending on the projectionist and how fast the projectionist switches reels and whatnot. And it's also very hard to write about, I should say, because you're watching...
Which film are you writing about?
It's watching two screens, so there's a certain degree of complexity, and it's a fairly long film. It's not quite 4 hours, but it's over 3.5 hours.
What's it about?
It's about life in the Chelsea Hotel. I mean, that's the idea of it. It's supposed to be different rooms. This is all taking place in the Chelsea Hotel, although the concept, there are some holes in the concept.
How did mainstream critics react?
Well, the mainstream critics, for instance, the New York Times or the Variety or Time Magazine thought it was boring and chastised him for what he was doing. But Jack Kroll in Newsweek wrote a rave review, as did Jonas Mekas in The Voice. But the Jack Kroll article, the review, called it the Iliad of the Underground.
Hmm.
He actually wrote a good review of the film. It created a lot of attention for the film, and a lot of people did get to see the film as a result. If he had a better distributor, he would have made it a lot more money.
Is there an overarching philosophy that Warhol had about film that would kind of pull all of his films together?
Well, I think the thing that Warhol was most interested in was he was really trying to understand cinema. And so he was really experimenting. He wanted to push the boundaries of cinema. So I think that if there's one thread through his work is that he was trying not to repeat himself, and he was always trying to do something different every time that he made a film. And that's very difficult to do. And I think that he was asking a lot of questions about the medium in the same way that he questioned what was painting, what was sculpture. He was also questioning what is cinema.
J.J. Murphy is a filmmaker and film professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the author of The Black Hole of the Camera, the films of Andy Warhol. He spoke with Ann Strainchamps. And this is Dean and Britta, with music from their album 13 Most Beautiful, songs for Andy Warhol's screen tests. Who's the most imaginative screenwriter working today? A lot of people would name Charlie Kaufman. Kaufman won an Oscar for his screenplay for Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. He's also been nominated for his screenplays for Being John Malkovich and Adaptation. Now his stories have inspired a collection of essays called The Philosophy of Charlie Kaufman. Kim Evans contributed an essay on his 2002 film, Adaptation.
Isn't that just the risk one takes for attempting something new? I should leave here right now. I'll start over. I need to face this project head on.
And God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing. Any idiot can write voiceover narration to explain the thoughts of a character. Okay, that's it. 1 hour for lunch.
Your essay focuses on the 2002 film Adaptation. It was written by Charlie Kaufman, directed by Spike Jones. I'm sure there are some of our listeners who are not familiar with it. Can you give us a kind of brief synopsis of the storyline of Adaptation?
Yeah, I can sure try. It's the story of a screenwriter, Charlie Kaufman, who's been hired to make out of a lyrical, meditative piece of nonfiction prose a film script. And Charlie Kaufman is not a struggling writer, because his talents have been recognized. But he struggles as a writer, in part because he has the twin goals of, on the one hand, trying to be true to his material, and on the other, writing something new. And then complicating this scenario is the fact that the material that he's working with, Susan Orlean's The Orchid Thief, is a book that isn't really about anything, or Charlie says it's about disappointment. The writer, Susan Orlean, is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and the book began life as one of those sprawling New Yorker essays about, loosely, about the aspirations of a orchid poacher, John LaRoche. And then there's the matter of Charlie's crippling self-consciousness, which occasionally dips into self-loathing, but really is also the source of his genius.
So many things to talk about. But basically, this is a film about the difficulty Charlie Kaufman has writing a film about the difficulty that Charlie Kaufman has writing about but at the same time, as you say in the essay, there really is nothing in this film that is referential. So you're saying we're really not to make anything of the fact that the character Charlie Kaufman, played by Nicolas Cage, is struggling to adapt Susan Orlean's book, which is the same thing that's facing the real-life Charlie Kaufman.
Yeah. What we want to remember is that, of course, everything, and Charlie Kaufman would say this, everything is autobiographical whether you want it to be or not. But he's also trying to get us to think that there is a real difference, an important difference between fiction and reality, and also between fiction and the kind of writing that is interested in writing about reality. And so what he's giving us is an argument for fiction, what fiction's for, and what fiction is. And that is the reason why I think it's important to understand that when Charlie Kaufman, the writer, names Charlie Kaufman the character, Charlie Kaufman, he's not asking us to think about himself. In fact, he names him Charlie Kaufman so that he stops us from thinking about himself and asks us instead to think about the things that he was thinking about, which is to say that we are forced, because we know that Charlie Kaufman, played by Nicolas Cage, isn't Charlie Kaufman, we're forced to think about the ways in which Charlie Kaufman was living and what he was dealing with, rather than who he is and where he lives and what he eats and et cetera.
But of course, anytime we watch a movie, there is a character played by an actor whose face we know. We understand from the beginning that it can't be the real person. So you're one step back. This is asking us to take yet another step.
I'd say it's even a step forward, in part because when we see a film about a guy who we know, played by another guy, we know that is being played. But we also know that the player is in some sense channeling this real person. So when Charlie Kaufman names his character Charlie Kaufman, he does something magnificently simple and yet extremely effective at helping to ensure that what we're watching is fiction. Because he names him Charlie Kaufman, we're forced to think about the fact that this character isn't in fact Charlie Kaufman. I mean, it's not an eternal regress is what I'm saying. He's actually thrusting us into the world of his fiction by insisting that this character, who's obviously a character, has his own name.
There's a further complication, of course. Not only does Nicolas Cage play Charlie Kaufman, but he also plays the twin brother Donald Kaufman. But there is no Donald Kaufman in the world we live in, right? He doesn't exist.
Well, you know, he doesn't exist.
Maybe he does.
Well, he forces us to think about the existence. And when we think about that, we understand that the material reality is quite different from something's existence, right? So there is obviously no body belonging to Donald Kaufman walking around in the world. But that voice that says to Charlie Kaufman, the writer, hey, you know what? You could work a lot less hard and make a lot more money. That voice exists.
There are no rules, Donald. And anybody who says there are
not rules, principles. McKee writes that a rule says you must do it this way. A principle says this works and has through all remembered time.
The script I'm starting, it's about flowers.
Oh.
Nobody's ever done a movie about flowers before. So there are no guidelines.
What about Flowers for Algernon?
Well, that's not about flowers.
Oh, okay.
And it's not a movie.
Sorry, I never saw it. Okay, keep going.
Look, my point is that those teachers are dangerous if your goal is to try to do something new. And a writer should always have that goal. Writing is a journey into the unknown. It's not building, you know, one of your model airplanes.
McKee is a former Fulbright scholar, Charles. Are you a former Fulbright scholar?
That voice is, of course, a voice that could speak to Charlie Kaufman. And if Charlie Kaufman gave that voice more authority, then we wouldn't have Charlie Kaufman's films and we wouldn't be able to have these kinds of conversations. So I'd say, yeah, he exists.
In your essay, you write that whatever gets cooked up in adaptation will be man-made, but assembled in a way that suggests supernatural rather than natural agency. Can you explain that to me?
Yeah. I will try. Let's say that it has something to do with the fact that this is a story that is like the story of Genesis. Okay, so let's start there. Then Genesis is the story of how the world in which we live was made against a background of infinite obscurity, right? Of blackness 10 times black. And if you happen to be secular, that's a way of saying that what sustains the world isn't something that's foundational. It's not what came before it, but something that's compositional, right? That the world is sustained by a kind of attention to the conditions of its own creation. And the idea that the world is this kind of composition is fundamental to a writer like Charlie Kaufman, who is obviously interested in composition as opposed to reflection when it comes to writing. And what he wants to do is create a world in that same way that reflects the truth of the world in which he lives, but not because it reflects the things in the world in which he lives. And what he needs to do then is pay attention to the conditions of the creation of the writing.
In the book, you also suggest that he tries to work around Genesis, perhaps, by thinking in Darwinian terms. He takes Charles Darwin and the way his thoughts affect his efforts to adapt the book. And he starts going the way we are tempted to do often by saying, okay, there was this and then that and then the other. But it quickly becomes very confusing for him, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. Although I would say that Genesis, as a story, and the story that Darwin tries to tell us are, in fact, very similar stories. This might get me a lot of hate mail from your listeners, but in fact, the story that Darwin's trying to help us understand is that whenever you look at something, whenever you grasp something, you're actually grasping the whole history of its evolution. That the thing you think you're coming into contact with is just a picture of a long story that reaches back to the beginning and reaches forward to not an end, but an ongoing middle. And so that whenever you look at something, you're actually looking at its evolution. And that's a very hard idea. And that's also the idea in Genesis, that what we have is not a story that has, in the Hellenistic tradition, right, a beginning and a middle and an end, but a story that is always ongoing, a story that is, Deleuze would say, all middle. And Genesis says is all beginning, that it's a beginning that begins again. And as it keeps beginning, you're forced to think about where you place yourself in the story. That these two stories are helping us to remember that that three-act structure that we're given, that we're told, is the way that we think, is actually a terrible disservice to both the idea of existence and to the idea of story.
And this is actually a very appealing idea to Charlie Kaufman, who wants to be constantly in the beginning.
Yeah. Well, does he want to be? No. Who wants to be always in the beginning? But when you tell that story and you tell it again and then you start again with the beginning and then you find that you want to go farther back, but you can't. I mean, he has that great moment when he's struggling and he can't work, and then he has this insight about Darwin, right? And how understanding anything means understanding the whole history of its life, which is to say all life. And he goes back and he tells this evolutionary story, and it's this moment of euphoria. And then the film captures perfectly the tragedy of listening to his ecstatic voice recycle this list.
Start right before life begins on the planet. All is lifeless. And then life begins with organisms, those little single cell ones. Oh, and it's before sex, because like everything was asexual. From there, we go to bigger things, jellyfish. And then that fish that got legs on it and crawled out onto land. And then we see, you know, like, dinosaurs, and then they're around for a long, long time, and then an asteroid comes and flork!
The insects, the extinct mammals, the primates, monkeys, the simple monkeys, the old-fashioned monkeys giving way to the new monkeys, whatever, and then apes, whatever, and man. Then we see the whole history of human civilization, hunting and gathering, farming, war, love, religion, heartache, disease, loneliness, technology. And we bring it all the way to this moment in history and end with Susan Orlean in her office at the New Yorker writing about flowers, and bang, the movie begins. This is great. This is the breakthrough I've been hoping for. It's never been done before. You see, it ties everything.
He is a genius.
It's perfect.
What we see as we see his flat voice listening to his euphoric voice is how ridiculous it is that Bronze Age would follow farming, or that, you know, man follows monkeys. That this thing that also Darwin was trying to help us understand is that even as things are linked, there's always these spaces, this unpredictable opportunity for new things. And as a writer, Charlie Kaufman is interested in new things, in the eruption of new things.
Kim Evans is the author of the essay Charlie Kaufman, Screenwriter. It's featured in the book The Philosophy of Charlie Kaufman, edited by David LaRocca. If you've seen the film Fight Club, you may remember that the first rule of Fight Club is that you do not talk about Fight Club. I wonder if that rule also applies to talking about our upcoming story about Fight Club. If it does, I might be in trouble. Either way, we'll put up our dukes and take on the philosophical content of Fight Club as we conclude our hour on films and philosophy. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Think we can't wax philosophical about the 1999 movie Fight Club? Think again. Barry Vacker teaches media, cultural, and utopian theory at Temple University. He's also written a book called Slugging Nothing, Fighting the Future in Fight Club. Vacker gets philosophical with Steve Paulson.
Brad Pitt and Edward Norton play these two sort of urban terrorists who lead a gang of disaffected males in these battles and fights in basements and in cellar dwellers and things like that. And they sort of beat each other up, but it becomes a metaphor for a larger issue in our society, and that is sort of this issue not only of lost masculinity, but sort of a frustration with the modern world. And so they develop an organization called Project Mayhem, which becomes a terrorist group that in the end detonates skyscrapers in the hopes of sort of bringing civilization back to all zero. In fact, it was the skyscrapers of credit card companies in the novel.
And the thing that's kind of sobering in retrospect is the movie was made before 9/11, and there's the sense that there's something a little predictive about it.
Yes, the final scene in Fight Club with the skyscrapers kind of imploding downward, you can't help but look at those images and immediately think, wow, I almost called the visual imagery of the Twin Towers collapsing in 2001.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of quotes that have kind of become famous from this movie, and you mentioned several of them in your introduction to your book.
Yes.
Which kind of get at the, I guess what you could call the existential conditions of Fight Club. Tell me what some of these quotes are.
Well, I think the one that's very striking is the one that is simply 3 minutes.
3 minutes. This is it. Ground zero.
That statement is made by Tyler Durden, portrayed by Brad Pitt. And just the mere fact that the beginning of the film and the beginning of the novel, nearly at the very beginning, there's references to ground zero, and they're in a skyscraper. And that seemed to clearly foreshadow 9/11, even though in this case, the terrorists are more urban, I guess you'd call them urban guerrillas, urban terrorists. They're not necessarily fundamentalist terrorists or anything like that, but certainly very similar language, very similar frustrations, and very similar ideologies at play. And so I think that the idea of this sort of ground zero, and of course the ultimate ground zero goes back to Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the idea of the center point of a detonation. And so I think in Fight Club, the ground zero means sort of a cultural detonation. It's not merely bringing down skyscrapers. The whole mission of Project Mayhem was to sort of bring civilization back to a pre-modern era, or actually I guess you would say a hunter-gatherer era.
Well, one of the other quotes is, it's Project Mayhem that's going to save the world, a cultural ice age, a prematurely induced ice age, which is...
Yeah, it's very evocative idea. Yeah, very evocative. And what I think is interesting about Fight Club is that it came out in 1999, and so did The Matrix. And whether you love or hate the films, and I'm neither a lover or hater of both, I kind of interpret them and make sense of them, they sort of captured a zeitgeist at that moment. If you recall, there was sort of the hysteria of the internet and the dot-coms, and the stock market was going up and up and up, yet at the same time, there was this fear of Y2K and that the internet would collapse. Growing up in the 60s and 70s, for me, the year 2000 was always this symbol of some kind of future, that beyond 2000, there would be a future. It seemed so futuristic, those three zeros, right? That's why Stanley Kubrick had 2001, A Space Odyssey. In the year 2001, we would be in this new millennium. And I think that what has happened with the phrases like that, a prematurely induced ice age, that there's something happening where I think our technologies have propelled us into the new millennium. I don't think that can be denied. All the scientific discoveries, the proliferation of the internet, all the things that are happening. In fact, we're having an explosion of art and science all over the planet. Yet, I think those very things that are being revealed by science have generated a reversal, and there's a much of our culture has not yet really entered the millennium. We haven't crossed over yet into that new era, and I think that's exhibited by a lot of the creationists, the fundamentalists, the desire to return to a simpler life or agrarian life, buy local, all those kinds of things, which would seem to me to at least putting a brake on certain notions of progress and trying to retreat backwards. And I think that in some sense we've gone past the year 2000 with technology, but I think most of our ideologies haven't.
Well, and the Brad Pitt character, Tyler Durden, keeps pressing this message that we need to wake up, we need to liberate ourselves. And there's another quote, with insomnia, nothing is real, everything's far away, everything's a copy of a copy.
Yeah, and when I read that line, I kept thinking that, you know, insomnia, you can't sleep, and actually I have sometimes problems with sleeping, but I think about the internet, it never sleeps. It just keeps going, it's there, it's running, it's just like it's on autopilot. And yet we can summon up on our screen all these images. They're representations of something else that's not there. And I think that the writer and the screenwriter sense that we know we've got all these media images coming into our houses, and we have all these things we can access 24/7 all the time to keep us awake, keep us distracted, keep us entertained. And yet the reality is farther and farther away. And I think this is where it harkens to some of the writer Jean Baudrillard's ideas about what we're creating with our media world is copies of copies of copies, and that the real world or the authentic world or the untouched world is getting further and further away.
So that's part of the idea behind these underground fight clubs, for instance.
Exactly.
I mean, these guys who get together and basically they knock the hell out of each other. And it's not so much about winning, about beating the other guy, but there's something about trying to get in touch with your more primal self.
I agree with you completely, and I think it's a question of authenticity, that you become more authentic and more real when you participate in this brutal battles. And you're right, it doesn't really matter who wins. The goal is to participate and somehow get in touch with a lost masculinity, and I think even more importantly, a lost authenticity.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've called your book about Fight Club Slugging Nothing. And you talk a fair amount about, well, what you call nothings and zeros. How do these figure into this movie?
Well, one thing you got to have with the book is hopefully a sexy title. So I thought Slugging Nothing would kind of, you know, Slugging Nothing, what's that about? A playoff, obviously, Fight Club. But in reading the book and in also seeing the films, there were numerous references to nothings, zeros, emptinesses, voids, absences, lacks, and all kinds of things like that. And to me, it hearkened to the issues raised by the late existentialist philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre, who theorized that we're always confronting these voids or these lacks or these nothingnesses, and it's how we deal with them. In other words, we come into the world with no food and shelter, so there's a lack in the material world, so what do? We create civilization, agriculture, industrial, what we might call post-industrial now or postmodern. And so we also have a lack of knowledge, a lack of information. So there's an emptiness in our minds, an emptiness in our consciousness. So we invent language and art and books and computers and the internet. But there's a third void that's perhaps the most terrifying, and that's the future. And that's why humans have to have a plan. We have to have a model. We have to hurl ourselves into the future. There's no exit from tomorrow, right? There's no way we can get escape from that responsibility. And so in the novel, there's an underlying tension, an antipathy toward the future, a hostility toward, an anxiety about it. And at some points, it almost seems very paranoid about that something is looming out there that is unbearable, and we need to retreat away from it.
Well, and in the movie, there's a great scene early on where the Edward Norton character, who has this corporate job, and he's outfitted his whole apartment with products from IKEA, and there's sort of this great scene of, you know, the camera pans over everything that's been bought from IKEA.
Yeah, fabulous.
Like so many others, I had become a slave to the IKEA nesting instinct.
Yes, I'd like to order the Erica Picari dust ruffles.
Please hold.
If I saw something clever, like a little coffee table in the shape of a yin-yang, I had to have it. The Klipsk personal office unit, the Hovatrek home exerbike, or the Yohannishov sofa with the string green stripe pattern, even the Rizlampa wire lamps of environmentally friendly unbleached paper. I'd flip through catalogs and wonder, what kind of dining set defines me as a person? I had it all. Even the glass dishes with tiny bubbles and imperfections, proof that they were crafted by the honest, simple, hardworking indigenous peoples of wherever.
I was holding.
Your call is important.
So why does he seem to be in love with IKEA?
Well, I think it's interesting because I think he's in love with it, and then over time he comes to loathe it. And that's why he detonates his entire condo, right?
Right, he blows it up. He blows up his whole condo and, you know, destroys everything in it.
Exactly, but when you really think about it, if you might go back to the 1950s, and Frank Lloyd Wright might be a household name, the very famous architect, or Buckminster Fuller, or some of these famous architects. Today, there are very few architects who are household names who are designing homes. We have developers and things like that. So when people think of homes and styles for living, they think of IKEA, or Home Depot, or Martha Stewart. And I think that IKEA, because it's most of its designs are sort of, I guess, copies of very modern and very clean lines on their furniture, for most people, that's probably as close as they're going to get to modern architecture or modern design or modernist sensibilities. And you can contrast that with the sort of domestic conservatism of Martha Stewart or the DIY Home Depot authentic home building kind of thing. And so you have these sort of three models for what the residence should be. You could have the IKEA version, the Martha Stewart, or the Home Depot. And the one that's most clearly identified with modern is IKEA. So I think that he's wrestling with modernism in that very struggle over IKEA versus whatever else he could think of.
Well, we should give a taste of this sort of unusual sense of the future as told by Tyler Durden. And I think it would actually be useful to maybe read a passage from the book by Chuck Palahniuk. And you have a passage in your book. Could you read that?
This is from the novel. You'll hunt elk through the damp canyon forest
around the ruins of Rockefeller Center. You'll wear leather clothes that will last you the rest of your life. You'll climb the wrist-thick cuts of vines that wrap the Sears Tower. And when you look down, you'll see tiny figures pounding corn, laying strips of venison in the empty carpool lane of some abandoned superhighway.
This was the goal of Project Mayhem, Tyler said, the complete and utter destruction of civilization.
You know, what's interesting is, you know, I mean, at the surface level, Fight Club is, you know, it's a pretty exciting movie. I mean, it kind of gets your adrenaline rushing.
And, yeah,
I mean, some people are totally turned off by it. I mean, it's just, you know, it's violent. People are knocking each other senseless and they're blowing up stuff. But you're also saying at this deeper level, it's a very philosophical movie. I mean, it raises profound questions about our lives, about what reality is all about.
It is very philosophical, and it resonates with today's youth at a variety of levels. And it still resonates. I'm not sure if it resonates exactly in the same way as it did in 1999, but it still resonates, and students are very intrigued by the discussions of it, what it means, what it's saying. For the most part, they're open to these larger stories or these larger ideas embedded within Fight Club, because I think they sense that it's saying something about their world, the urban metropolis where the majority of the world's citizens live, the majority of Americans live, and it's saying something about that lifestyle with all the advertising around us and all the furniture and all the rampant consumerism that we have. It's asking us to question that.
Barry Vacker is the author of Slugging Nothing, Fighting the Future in Fight Club. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Vacker is also the founder of the Center for Media and Destiny. You can find a link to the center's website on our website, ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Film and Philosophy. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.